You're listening to Trent Radio 92.7 FM. If you don't like it, your cat will.
Goeiedag. U luistert naar Trent Radio 92.7 FM in Peterborough.
Good afternoon again, and welcome to Art Space and Noise Space. Web Madman is just finishing up his sub, and we'll be here momentarily. Unfortunately, I didn't get to jam with Manlisher. Manlisher Carcano, their show was preempted by a football game or something. Something important. More important than art. Anyway, I don't know what our topic for today is going to be, so while I'm waiting, I'm just going to put on some tape loops.
Here, we must guard against a serious misapprehension when I say that the source of music is our emotional faculty. It must not be concluded that music is an expression of the feelings we know in the world, such as joy or sadness. These feelings are already a formulation of our psychic activity in a determinate affective situation. They are feelings motivated by a given set of circumstances which affect us, and they can be explained by what has motivated them. The feeling active in music, at least that which has been the source of our tonal structures, had no previous motivation. It has only come into play to express itself. And we have already seen that in the melodic progression, it consists of the continually renewed transition from the present position to one in the future. But such transitions give rise to different kinds of affective tensions. The future position towards which I tend may belong to my potential future in the world or to my past. As for instance, when I hope you return to the town where I was born. In the first place, we are concerned, let's say, with an extrovert tension. In the other case, introvert. Moreover, these tensions may be active or passive. They are active to the extent to which the future position is a discovery, passive insofar as your future is provided for us automatically, and we can only sum it. I cannot explain in this record how these different kinds of affective tensions are signified by the various intervals ascending or descending of our meaning, except in what concerns extroversion and introversion. You will probably not be surprised if I tell you that ascending tonal movement corresponds to extroversion, because both movements go in the existential direction of time tonal in the sounds and in our sound, while descending tonal movement corresponds to introversion, because both movements go in the retrograde direction of time tonal in the sounds and in our sound. However, this correspondence between tonal movement and our psychic tensions can only be convincingly brought to light by a careful study of the genesis of the intervals as we perceive them. In what I have just said, my sole aim has been to give you an idea of the specific character of meditation, in that it is not a direct product of the feelings we experience in the real world. In fact, what we experience in music is just musical feeling. That is to say, a feeling for tonal relationships and tonal structures. And this musical feeling is entirely made up of the four categories of affective tensions I have defined: active or passive in extroversion, active or passive in introversion. These tensions varying a degree of intensity proper to each interval. But these various affective tensions are nothing other than the elementary tensions that constitute the texture of our whole activity of feeling, of that activity of feeling which, in the world, takes the form of, for instance, joy or sorrow. And this is why, particularly when your rhythm comes into play, we are able to rediscover in the countless possible aspects of music an expression of the emotions we experience in real life. Yet, since what we meet with in music is just an expression of these emotions, they do not cause us pain in the way they could when suffered in real life. The fact that melody is an incidence of feeling will now make clear to us why it has a rhythmic structure. Our activity of feeling takes shape within us against the background of our respiratory cadence. I call respiratory cadence the alternation of inhalation and exhalation in our rhythm. Just as we could speak of cadence in describing the regular up and down of the legs of a man marching, or in describing the alternation of left-right, which determines the march of a soldier. The respiratory cadence confers a measure of duration to our activity of feeling. It creates a time measure which is specific.
All right there, boys and girls. It is Web Madman here for another week of Art Space, Noise Space. And I'm sitting here with the Pilot K9.
How do you do?
Very good. And earlier, Brian, Pilot K9, was asking me, what's the topic? And as usual, I'm like, oh, do we have one? And actually, it's a lie to say that I don't, because I was just listening to a bunch of Daniel Pinchbeck as I've been wandering around today.
All right. He's author of Breaking Open the Head.
Yep.
And an investigation into psychedelics.
Yes. And since then, he's also done World on Fire and The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
I haven't read either of those.
Yeah. He's... it's interesting, and it, with these lectures, it really gives a lot of, like, amazing nuance, sorry about that, to his writing, in that he's one of those people that doesn't, you know, he's not a 100% believer in anything.
And well, good.
Yeah, no, exactly, and is constantly sort of reinventing things. But what the main thing that he's talking about these days is about the initiatory process. How we seek out going through these processes that change us fundamentally, the way that we see things, the way that we interact and engage the world.
Yeah, I should do one of those soon.
And in relation to that, he's talking about 2012, the
supposed end of the Mayan calendar.
That's right. Which, I mean, there's lots of speculation one way or the other, the accuracy, the, you know, whether this is anything at all. He takes it on not as much as a given event, as much as a kind of temporary marker point, in that looking around, we can see that we're in an accelerated culture. Things are changing very, very rapidly.
Faster than we can keep up with.
That's right. And you know, leaving us with the question as to whether we ever really caught up in the first place. and so part of what's happening right now is that people are seeking out transformative, initiatory sort of experiences. Bringing it around to one of the things that I feel is possible within a noise environment and a jam space.
And a multimedia collaborative project.
That's right. Because just like with Aldous Huxley talks about heaven and hell, there's The Doors of Perception, there was two essays, that Heaven and Hell was the other one, that the book that I read anyway had those two together, and I've seen them sort of
right
compiled.
And the Max Ernst cover painting.
That's right, that's the one.
An appropriate selection.
Yeah, no, very much so. And within the Heaven and Hell, he talks about when you go years ago, before our modern world, when you would go to church, it was an inherently mystical experience, because there was color that you wouldn't see anywhere else in the stained glass and in the paintings and stuff.
All right. Bright colors in clothing and architecture. And
that's right.
Advertising obviously wasn't around.
No. And so, you know, pretty much your entire world was, you know, sort of within a certain color scheme and within a certain sort of visual matrix.
There were a lot more flowers back then.
There were, but flowers have an organic nature, whereas the church has something that is distinctly human about it.
And something distinctly inhuman as well.
Well, yeah. and so you would go to this place that was completely unique within your, you know, visual space. You would sit for hours sort of anesthetized by, you know, sort of rhetoric and talk, broken by actual singing and, you know, these kind of experiential things. And given that, you would have an experience, a transformative experience.
Transcendent.
Yes. And so this is what, you know, Aldous Huxley was talking about, as, you know, the ingredients for altering your consciousness and bringing about epiphany, revelation, insight.
Peak experience.
Exactly.
Is the Maslow term.
Yep. And so now we live in a world that we're just completely saturated in hallucinatory imagery. We're sitting right here in front of a computer screen, and if nothing else, a computer screen is a hallucination.
Yeah, just about.
I could go in depth as to the influence that LSD had on the early beginnings of digital technology. If you look back at the folks that were developing all that early stuff,
they were drug takers.
Oh yeah. there's been more than a little bit of speculation about, you know, the various altered states of consciousness leading to our modern computer world.
One thing is that drugs, psychedelics especially,
mm-hmm.
Give you a different perspective on things.
Yep.
When you take a trip, you come back with maybe not explicit knowledge,
right?
But a change in your thinking can become more versatile.
Yeah.
More open to possibility.
Yep. Well, and this is where I know in my own, you know, kind of journeys through things, I've seen different ways of engaging and coming through the experience, where I think that there's an unfortunate tendency with the majority of people when they do alter their consciousness, they don't necessarily do anything to contextualize what they've experienced. And so they come away the next day unchanged.
Except for a bit of a drug hangover.
Right. And a vague impression that they had experienced something. But there's no context to bring it into their everyday life. There's no ritual that enables them to pull what they've gained from that experience into their actual ongoing.
Right, to make some meaning from
yes.
it.
That's right.
That you can apply to the rest of your life.
That's right. So to contextualize that with the, you know, kind of the noise jam or an experience of purposely getting together to explore things in a non-hierarchical open kind of way, I think can also open up those types of experiences.
Especially during the period when we were under the wolf.
Uh-huh.
We would play like mad.
Yeah.
Like for an hour.
Yeah.
But we'd all stop at the same time.
Yeah.
Look at each other and say, wow. How did we do that?
Well, and I think we've commented on this before about how that's one of the things that we can, we use as a monitor to sort of see that we're in sync. And is that we go through those kind of things where we'll go for a huge amount of time and then just all kind of stop at the same time. Like yeah. There's this kind of like natural kind of like, yeah. This is where we end. It just shows that there's a syncing going on. There's a synchronizing. But
that's after we're playing for about an hour.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is pretty intense. And we also notice the time dilation effect.
Yeah.
Like we look at the recording and it's an hour or an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And nobody believes it.
No. It's like that was like 20 minutes, wasn't it?
Because we're not conscious of yeah. playing for an hour and a half.
Well, and this strikes on one of the other thing that Pinchbeck was talking about in what I've been listening to, is looking at time not as a quantitative thing, but as a qualitative thing. And that, you know, yes, we can sort of break time up into these linear segments, but that within the experience of time, there is shifts where it expands, contracts, and he also relates it to how we are in an accelerated time right now, so the advancement in for certain things that we do takes, you know, a fraction of the time that it once took, right? So, you know, it took us 100 years to get to a certain point, and then 50 years to get to the next point, and then 20 years, and then, you know, and it just keeps halving itself.
Right, well, that's most apparent in computer technology.
That's right, and that's Moore's Law. Talks about how, you know, computer, the
processing power
and will rise exponentially.
Right.
And it's completely, actually, it's surpassed Moore's Law. in a number of cases. So not only was it sort of right on, it was slightly conservative in terms of...
That's a bit frightening to think about.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's actually, if you go online and look up Moore's Law, M-O-O-R-E, okay. Oh, look at that. We have a computer sitting right there. It's fascinating how quickly these things are occurring. Look at that, Wikipedia. Now, as I always tell people about Wikipedia, Wikipedia is only a reference point to start from. The most important thing is to check the links at the bottom, because it'll just give you somebody's synopsis of what's going on. But then from there, if you want to really find things out, make sure that you check with the bottom where you've got links to the external sites, where the information is coming from.
This one is actually a pretty comprehensive article.
Yeah.
And take a look at this.
Yeah. No, it's true. And that's the thing, is that the information that's on the Wikipedia page that isn't necessarily inaccurate, but be aware that it is just written by somebody. Bickered
not
over.
Not necessarily a scholar.
Right. And can be bickered over like crazy. If you've ever gone into the discussion pages of any Wikipedia page.
Not often. That's so big.
It's very funny.
You could get lost in there.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a whole thing in itself. But yeah, no. Okay, so Gordon E. Moore was a co-founder of Intel, of course. Wrote his paper on it in 1965, and he's actually specifically talking about the number of transistors that can be placed inexpensively on an integrated circuit has increased exponentially, doubling approximately every 2 years. And we're actually going past that. Oh, it looks like we have a phone call. No, that's line two. Is that the...
That's the on-air line.
That's the on-air line. Okay, well, shall we just kind of open it up and see who they are?
Okay.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hey.
Rock 107, am I the 107th caller?
You are not 107th caller. You are my first caller right now.
Oh.
And who am I talking to?
Well, I'm another programmer on the Trent radio there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, 2:30 to 3 every Friday.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking outside the politically correct box.
Ooh, okay. What's your show about?
It's about religion, politics, anything controversial.
Oh, yeah.
Anything offensive, anything fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Offense they often can be go fun. Together.
Yeah, 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 they can.
For sure.
So, what would you like to say? What's on your mind today?
You're talking about blind faith, or it's not good to have blind faith in anything earlier?
That's right.
Right, and then I was listening for a while, and then you got onto Wikipedia?
Yes.
And everything? And do you still have that page up?
Yeah, Moore's Law.
All right. You want to look something else up?
Sure.
All right. It's somebody's name.
Yeah.
Just type it into the search there.
Yep.
Rene...
Mm-hmm.
R-E-N-E.
Yeah.
Space.
Mm-hmm.
Gerard. G-I-R-A-R-D.
Oh, I-A. Hold on. Spell that again.
Gerard?
Yeah.
G-I-R-A-R-D.
Oh, hold on. I'm trying to find the backspace on this. There it is.
Whoa. And look it up.
Gerard. Okay.
Right, it's that new keyboard with the backspace in a weird position.
Oh, there we go. Somebody else has already been here and looked it up. Look at that. Aha. Okay. French historian, literary critic, and philosopher of social science.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think you were talking about, who was it, Kafka earlier, with the idea that time isn't...
Really Pinchbeck, sad. Actually, but yes. Yeah?
What was his name, sorry?
Daniel Pinchbeck.
Okay.
Who's a modern author.
And that wasn't Franz Kafka who came up with that idea?
Those things have definitely been, and that's what Pinchbeck talks about, how there's been a lot of talk of this sort of thing over the years.
It's based on feelings and...
Some of it's based on feelings, but then he Pinchbeck actually also relates it into some of the recent discoveries with quantum physics, subatomic particles and how they work, and there seems to be different times at work or different timelines going on there.
Well, look up or read the René Girard page, right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And tell me if you think that it, after that, that it would be reasonable to have blind faith in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking at it?
I'm looking at it, but I mean, at the same time, I mean, where I'm also on a radio show, so I don't want to stop talking and just start reading here.
This is a note. Girard's work also tends to be controversial due to his harsh criticisms of modern philosophy mm-hmm. and his outspoken Christian views.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he converted because of his theories.
Okay.
And he used to be what's it called? The atheistic intellectual.
Right.
Part of atheistic intellectualism.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I would like to differentiate myself on that one in that I would probably refer to myself more as agnostic, leaning towards Gnostic myself, having had various experiences that I can't put in any boxes that fit with any kind of non-spiritual kind of framework.
Very good.
And I suppose that the one writer that I would probably most resonate with is Robert Anton Wilson.
Don't know.
He wrote the Illuminati trilogy back in the 70s, and he discusses what he calls maybe logic, and basically puts across saying, look, you're a human being, human beings are fallible, we can't actually, none of us are able to see and know everything, so we need to take that into consideration.
How about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if someone, or what if the source of all knowledge, right,
mm-hmm.
came to Earth to tell us what we need to know and to tell us everything?
I'm not sure that we could actually hear it. I'm not sure that there's an intelligence that could put it into terms that could be translatable into what we can perceive.
Well, no, but let's say something is powerful enough to create the whole universe, right?
Right.
Why wouldn't that something also be powerful enough to come to Earth and to give us a message and to teach us the good life, etc.?
Because I'm not sure that's something that actually exists.
Sorry? Oh, okay. All right. Well, let me put it this way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been where you were before, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but okay.
No, I have.
No, you have no idea.
Well, okay, well, by a broad definition.
Okay.
Did the universe just come out of itself?
No.
So.
See, I don't disagree that there is forces or a force larger, much, much larger than ourselves. That's part of the reason why part of it is that I do see that human beings are somewhat insignificant in the actual grand scheme of the universe, looking at it on those sorts of scales. I'm sort of edging around is that I don't believe in any kind of anthropomorphized singular God.
Okay.
That would be what my main critique would be. I do think that there is something underlying, but it's something that I do not feel that any of us could ever know quantitatively while we are still in a human body.
I sort of thought about it that way too before, uh-huh. until I discovered Girard.
Uh-huh.
And I know you're a university student, right?
Nope.
Oh, you're not?
I'm completely self-taught.
Okay, well, if you have time on your hands to
uh-huh.
read.
Yeah. I know I do a lot of reading.
Read some books by Girard.
Okay. I will do that.
And it will shake it all.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's the most unique argument.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, you know, William Lane Craig and Peter Kreeft and people like that?
Peripherally. I've actually, because in my own sort of path, I've started to be far more interested in Aboriginal shamanic practices than things that are, you know, kind of structured within hierarchical religious institutions and those types of things.
Can you say the last part again?
Rather than things that are sort of locked into institutionalization, which is most of the things that I see coming from a Christian perspective tends to be ensconced in that type of thing. So it's just, I mean, it's a personal view. Yeah, there's another phone call, but that's okay. Gosh, we're busy down here today.
That's what she said. What was I going to say? If you read Girard, right?
Right.
What he doesn't try to defend the church as an institution. He doesn't talk about it.
Right.
He talks about just, you know, Christianity, the belief,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And he's his background is in the humanities.
Yeah.
So it's not the theology.
Right.
It's just philosophy
mm-hmm.
and anthropology that is Christian,
right?
If that makes sense, right?
Yep.
Theoretical anthropology that needs Christianity for the rest of the theories,
right?
So it's not like all of his books. Some aren't even about that. Some are.
Right.
It's just one aspect
of where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Very.
No, I'm always interested in you know sort of digging up. Different perspectives on things, and I mean, I would be very reluctant to dive into talking specifics until I've had a chance to really read where he's coming from.
Yes, by all means.
But because I do come from many years ago now. I was very strong born again Christian, and. Sort of got to the point where I needed to get past any of those sorts of labels and stuff and look more at what are the underlying principles that are motivating me in this. And, you know, they are, I mean, my underlying morals have not changed, but my need to identify with a specific label has dropped away.
Really?
Yeah. So that's all I'm, you know, because underneath it, I think that most spiritual traditions have certain lessons and messages, and that they're simply adapted to the different social circumstances for people to understand.
Well, I don't think it's just a matter of, like, if Christianity is, you know, fitting yourself, like a psychological need to put yourself in a box. It's more of a relationship.
Uh-huh.
And whatever, and when people explained it to me this way before, I thought it sounded like childish and silly,
mm-hmm.
right? But then after you read Girard, you realize that it's really the opposite, and it's the most rational and sound thinking system there is. And
right.
it's not a hindrance on thought; it's really a fundamental help
mm-hmm.
and an enhancer of it.
Right.
So, I mean, I can't really argue it any further. I think you need to go out and read some Girard because...
Have a look.
So you'll understand what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
Do you need... Yeah, you probably need the line clear for the other guy to get on the air, don't you?
Well, we can only have the line that you're on air, so...
Yeah,
I'm just noticing by here that the light has gone off, so Brian's already handled it. But some interesting ideas, and I'll be sure to digest some, and maybe give you a call on your show.
Yeah, it's 2:30 to 3 every Friday.
Right.
And I have a promo.
Uh huh.
Right.
Yeah.
If you can, you go to that folder.
Do you know the promo folder?
Let's see it. Let's see if it's on the Trent Radio Self Serve.
It would be under D. Dolesky.
Right.
Okay.
These computers are so much fun. There you go. All right.
It's called Muddy Waters Promo.
I've got your theme songs.
Yeah, there's a theme song, but
that very first
here
one
we go.
There. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. At the end of your show, could you do me a big favor and play that?
Sure.
Awesome. And when I play, when I have my next show, I will play your promo.
I don't think we have one yet.
Well, you gotta make a promo. That's like the most important.
Right.
The flip.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the flip side of it is that Brian's got a number of promos for his as well. Pilot
yeah.
K9?
I haven't made a new promo, actually, in a couple of years. I'm using the same one.
Really?
That's okay. You've been doing, you know.
But, I mean, I've had the same time slot for years.
Right. So yeah. It all kind of fits together.
Is it in, would it be under B. Wagner then, Brian Wagner?
It should be on the Trent Radio self-serve website under Program Promos.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, so no, it's not, actually. It's been revised.
Changed it all.
So there's only the new promos here.
But other than that, you've got your stuff under there, right? Under B. Wagner?
I do not, because I, unfortunately, I overloaded the server and caused John Muir some headaches. So he removed my entire folder and put it someplace where initially I couldn't find it.
Right. But now it can do no harm to the rest of the...
Yeah, he put it someplace safe where I'm not going to screw up anybody else's files.
If I find it, I will... if I find your promo, I will definitely play it.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
Cool.
And so before I go, I just have one joke to tell you.
Okay.
Moral relativism.
Uh-huh.
That's the joke.
Ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha.
All right. See you later.
Okay, okay, man. See you.
Thanks for calling.
Yep, thanks.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Yeah, well, you get some interesting folks.
Well, I'm going to check this out.
Yeah,
Rene
no.
Rene Girard.
Yep, Rene Girard. Yeah, no, I see some, you know, as we've been scrolling through.
The Dark Box of the Origin of Language.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this has got to be interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. Anyway.
I've done, not extensive research in this area, but...
yeah.
But I'm curious about the way language structures your thought.
Right.
And I think it would be useful to, I took French and German in school.
Right.
But I think it would be useful to expand my range of possible thought by learning a completely different language.
Right.
And Japanese would be probably most practical.
Right. Yes, no, that would certainly break you out of your box. Speaking of dark boxes. No, and that's actually, as you're saying that, it also resonates for me with the William S. Burroughs and Language as a Virus. That is altered the humans completely.
Well, yeah, in the...
Mm-hmm.
I think in a similar way to technology.
Yeah. Well,
you
I
can
see
make the argument that language is a technology.
Exactly, and actually that all of our technology is an evolution out of language. Particularly our modern technology and the whole digital computer world. I mean, it's all about language. I mean, it is. That's its basis.
Mm-hmm.
And now I guess the trick in there would be if you considered mathematics a language.
That's a difficult one.
That is a very difficult one. I would actually consider mathematics a language. I do see that there are certain things that seem from our perspective to be unshakably true. You know, 1 + 1 = 2. You have, you know, that seems pretty unshakable.
Guy disproved that.
Oh, you see, this is what I'm saying, is that, you know, there's no way of pulling that all the way through to saying that this is absolutely
right.
true.
You can provide any number of examples
right.
where 1 + 1 = 2, but that doesn't constitute a proof.
That's right. And so starting at that, and if you dig deep and deep and deep into the whole mathematical matrix, you know, it's all based on axioms and theorems, which are assumptions. And as it is right now, in the universe that we live in the world we live in, and as human beings, it all works, and it makes mm-hmm. sense.
Well, an axiom to begin with is something that's considered to be self-evident.
Right. But that's, again, assumption, right?
Yes.
In its non-pretty form. but, I mean, that being said, I do know that, you know, none of the stuff that we're sitting in front of right now would work if... those axioms weren't true enough for us to develop all this technology out of.
Right. This relates to Niels Bohr
mm-hmm.
and the
the quote from him, and it doesn't matter if a theory is objectively true or not.
Yeah.
What matters is it useful?
Exactly, exactly. Now, is it Bohr that talks about how the observer has an impact on the actual thing that is being observed?
He must have said something about
yeah.
that, but that's Heisenberg.
Was it Heisenberg? Because I think Heisenberg was more about how there are too many variables within any situation for you to have a sure answer. The uncertainty principle
right.
is based on the fact that we can never know everything. And because we can never know everything, you know, there's always going to be, you know, some factor that we cannot consider. So there's, you know,
right.
and that's the... because I know that the uncertainty principle tends to get confused with some of Bohr's theories around observer and what's being observed. Because the other thing in there, too, is that you see what you want to see, which is also a slight difference.
You see what you believe.
You see what you believe, yeah. But, I mean, there is this, and this is what Pinchbeck gets into, is the actual weight of intentionality. That your actual belief alters the actual reality that you're observing. That's a tricky one.
Well, okay. I would say that everyone inhabits their own reality.
Right.
Whatever reality exists outside of us
yeah.
is only perceivable through our senses and yeah. those limitations.
Yes.
And then they are interpreted through our language and our culture.
Right.
And that growing up in a particular language and culture,
yeah.
Certain brain networks will be stimulated
yeah.
and grow,
mm-hmm.
and others actually die out.
Yep.
Like a newborn baby has twice as many brain cells as an adult.
Right.
And the ones that aren't stimulated
die.
The ones that are stimulated grow and branch and right. connect.
So the lesson is use it or lose it.
That's true, yeah. But this affects the way we can then perceive
yeah.
and think about reality.
Uh-huh.
And when somebody from a different culture says, we see things differently,
right.
that's literally true.
That's literally true. There was this thing about the color blue. I remember reading at one point how there's speculation that the color blue was not perceivable by, you know, human beings at one point in time. Because apparently there's no reference to it within certain strains of literature and stuff. It's very weird.
Literature. So they're saying that this is a recent change?
Yes. Because there's a point in one of Homer's things where, and not the Simpsons Homer either, but where he refers to the sea as being red. And there's a whole whack of speculation around how it's because they were not perceiving the color blue at that point in time.
Is there a reference to purple?
Don't know.
The reason I ask is that,
yeah.
Well, red is the longest yeah. wavelength of light.
Right.
And purple is the shortest.
Shortest, that's right. So maybe it's, you know, we weren't able
to... And you know
to...
how... an octave,
yeah.
when you double the frequency
yeah.
or half the frequency,
yes.
You get a harmonious interval called
yep.
the octave.
That's right.
Well, the difference between violet
yeah.
and red light, the wavelength is almost
an octave.
Almost double.
Right.
So therefore, it's almost an octave.
Right.
And that's why we can perceive the color wheel,
yes.
where the violet, the
yeah.
shortest wavelength, blends into the red.
Yes, right. Yeah. No, because, yeah, if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, yeah, like you see that the color starts from the red and then ends from purple going into red. But, yeah, no, very, very trippy.
Yeah. But if we can only see one octave of light, that's
yeah.
That seems kind of odd and limited to me because
right.
we can hear about 10 octaves
right.
In the sound range
right.
from 20,000 from 20 to 20,000 hertz.
Right.
Although the higher frequencies drop off pretty rapidly as you get older.
Yeah. Because those little hairs in there, they get blasted.
Yeah, I made this oscillator with my science research kit.
Oh, yeah.
My electronics kit. And I turned it down
until I could just barely hear this sound.
Yeah.
And I came to my parents and I was all excited that, hey, check this out. This is the highest frequency that a human can hear.
Right.
I don't hear anything. They didn't.
Well, and we actually, I remember doing that in electricity class when I was in high school. And we had a signal generator that just had a dial. It was great. And we would play with it and get it to the point where, you know, figuring out who in the class could hear the highest.
Right.
And it was kind of neat. It was very neat. I actually, me and my friend Frank actually were able to hear the highest frequency.
Wonder why that is.
I don't know.
Maybe because you never played guitar?
Could be. Spent most of my time in the bush away from lots of cars and constant noise.
Yeah.
But I do remember that the higher end, it's more like feeling than hearing. Because it's like you can almost feel it against your ear more so than actually
or in
hearing.
Your teeth.
Exactly. It's kind of like that. Whoa, what is that?
Yeah, you can actually drive somebody nuts with a high frequency.
Yeah.
That's just on the threshold of hearing.
Yeah.
Because, well, for one reason,
you
have no idea where it's coming from.
That's right. There's no directional, like, where is that? Can also drive your dog crazy.
Yeah, well, dogs can hear a lot higher frequencies
than
we can.
Yeah. Yes, which is, you know.
I don't know, though, if they can hear lower frequencies.
That'd be a good
question. I think their whole hearing range is shifted up higher frequencies than ours.
Right.
But it's been pointed out that animals seem to react to a coming earthquake.
Okay.
You know, but before we figure anything out.
But you know what? They won't bat an eye if somebody farts.
What? Yeah.
We're the only ones that seem to be at all uncomfortable with that whole bodily function, but... Sorry. Just needed to get some levity in there.
All right. It's the opposite of gravity.
That's right. but no, like with creatures, that would be... Because I know that with cats, they don't really perceive color that well. But that's part of the reason why they can see really well in the dark.
Right. Well, our own dark vision.
Yep. The cones as opposed to the rods.
Yeah, there's when we to what extent we can see in a very low light situation, it's pretty much black and white and gray.
Yeah.
Although we don't, it's not obvious to us because usually we're looking at something that we know what color it is in daylight anyway.
Yeah. Although, I mean, it was, I noticed it. I remember, you know, as a kid, I was one of those strange kids that always observed things about myself. And I do remember going outside at night and, you know, I'd call it the black and white world.
So you clued in pretty early.
Yeah. Because when it was, I mean, part of it was that I grew up without running water. So you had to go outside a lot.
Right.
I'll let everyone fill in the blanks for that one. So you go outside at nighttime all the time. And, you know, you didn't want to get, you know, struggle with getting a light or a flashlight or whatever. You just stumble out and do your thing. And so you got to know your way around in the dark really well.
Yeah. There was something else that I just thought of, though. Mm-hmm. Your peripheral vision.
Yeah.
Sees movement rather than color.
Right.
So if something really is in your peripheral vision,
yes.
You can't tell what color it is. You can just tell that it's
the
moving.
The movement of it. Yeah.
And when you say that cats don't perceive color well,
yeah.
But what they do perceive is movement.
Yes. Yep. No, they pick up on that like that. And I mean, that's, you know, everyone's seen cats, you know, hunting in hunt mode.
Yeah. Well, there's this assumption among people.
Yeah.
Well, you see in a movie where they're trying to portray a dog's point of view.
Yeah.
They put the camera along the ground and they do it in black and white.
Yeah.
But everything still looks the same.
Yes.
Well, it wouldn't look the same.
At all.
To a dog.
No.
We don't have a dog's nervous system to perceive and interpret.
Yeah.
And there's this assumption that we see things as they really are.
Yes.
And that other animals are limited.
Yeah. Now, the other side of that, and this is one of the things where you were mentioning earlier, is it useful? And in terms of this is something that I look at a lot in terms of anthropomorphizing, and it's something that we do with everything. We attribute human characteristics to pretty much everything. And I think that the reason we do that is so that we can actually have a framework to observe things. So, you know, if you were to actually genuinely get in there, figure out how a dog sees things, and then try to put that on a screen, people wouldn't know what the hell you were doing.
That's right, with a different nervous system. Well,
yeah.
Well, we don't see when we're born. We don't.
Yeah.
We don't in the pre-verbal stage. We don't remember anything.
Right.
But everything's quite I wouldn't say a blur. I mean, it's really hard to say, but synesthetic.
Yes. There's a complete overlap.
Overlap of the senses.
Yeah.
They're not developed and not differentiated.
Yeah.
The way they become when we're older.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think part of that is that we haven't yet, at that point, developed the sorting and storing routines. There's been, in terms of brain memory kind of study, they've talked about how there is the short-term and long-term memory systems.
Right.
And the process of memory moving from short-term to long-term, there's an encoding process that goes on with that. That's kind of like writing something on an index card or whatever, you know, like there's this kind of way in which it's stored so that it can be accessed in the future.
Right.
And I think that sort of mechanism isn't something that's fully developed initially, and that it's something that we develop over time, because even, you know, if you think right now, what is your earliest memories and how far back do they go? You know, once you start going earlier than, say, like 9 years old, things start to get sporadic and fuzzy for a lot of people. Anyway.
Pretty vague. And
yeah.
You can remember stuff that you'll tell your
yeah.
parents, your relatives,
yeah. Yeah.
and they'll have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. Yeah.
Although the event may have happened.
Yeah.
But you remember it in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and then that's part of it, right? Is that, you know, now there are some memories that, of course, are more prevalent because, and this is the other thing, is that I found in myself, anyway, whenever I remember a memory, right, when I pull it up into my memory,
right.
I leave an imprint of that remembering on that memory so that the next time that I remember that memory, there is a residual of every time I've remembered that memory.
Right, you also remember remembering.
Exactly. And then, of course, there's, you know, you were mentioning relatives, and so there's certain stories that you have kind of a vague memory of, but then it's got layers and layers of other people having told that story to you.
Yes.
So you have, you know, sort of like this kind of like kernel that may or may not come from your actual original memory, but it's got these like kind of layers of you remembering the memory and other people, you know, kind of telling you the story. So,
well, memory is more synthetic than people would like to admit or even know.
Yeah. Oh, it's very malleable. And I mean, this is where in my own development, and to sort of relate back to the initiatory transformative experiences, I don't know whether I've been lucky or unlucky, but I've had quite a number of these kind of like life-changing, revelatory, break-open-my-head kind of experiences.
Right, now that would tend to be more like the photographic memory.
Well, yes, the memory of those events, but here's the interesting thing is that every time I've gone through that, when I then go back and start accessing my older memories, I perceive them differently.
Well, yeah, sure. Any transformative experience will sort of...
It shifts your relationship with things.
Including your relationship with yourself.
Exactly.
The way you perceive yourself.
That's right. So...
Yeah, so you'll begin to... You'll reinterpret your old memories in a new way.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's actually one of the things that I know from, you know, various people that, including myself, that have gone through... life-changing experiences, and a very common thing is wanting to go back through a number of very familiar experiences to re-experience it with your new self. And so, you know, you will, you know, sort of as an example, somebody that's been born again, you know, like a Christian that saw the light and now they're, you know, kind of born again. And they want to, you know, there's a part of them that wants to share that experience with everyone, which gets into the kind of proselytizing and stuff. Like, I understand that in that kind of context, that it's like they're so excited they want to share this, right?
Well, a simple example would be when someone says, talks about their youth before their conversion.
Right.
And they'll say, I didn't know it at the time,
but
I was in the grip of the devil or sin or temptation. Or
Yes. Well, and...
whatever. And you have obviously have a radically different perspective
on that now.
Yeah.
That's right. And the other part of that is wanting to sort of go back through, again, these familiar experiences and re-experience them with this new perception, with new eyes, and say, wow, okay, well, now what does this look like?
Right.
But I do think, to sort of come back around again to what we were talking off about in the start of the show, is I think that we are at a point now where it would be really good for us to consciously engage in creating the space for ourselves and others to have transformative experiences. And I mean that with, you know, not just, you know, having a singular good time a single night and then go back to...
No, you're talking about an ongoing process.
Ongoing process. And, you know, like, sometimes there is, like, these kind of, like, gestalts, right? So you try to create these spaces for people to experience these gestalts, and then they can go off and, you know, as a different person, you know? A filmmaker who has actually tried to do that is Jodorowsky.
Right.
Particularly his first two films, The Holy Mountain and El Topo, where he was actually trying to make film that would radically transform the viewer. He was really into, you know...
transforming the viewer.
Yeah. And in that sense, I mean, he was kind of an initiator of a new kind of cinema, in a way, that I've yet to see anybody... really take up and take any further.
He's often dismissed as being surrealist. Although that's certainly an influence on him.
Yes. And it's also to look at what surrealism is, which is really in essence the attempt to externalize the subconscious, in a really sort of crude and Cole's Notes kind of way. It's like, just get it out of your head and onto something, right?
So surrealism is, sur is the French word, on top of or above
realism. That's right. And so just from, you know, reading the various manifestos, you know, can sort of see that basically they're saying that the dream, the subconscious, the, you know, unconscious mind is a major part of our reality, but we dismiss it completely and trying to, you know, reclaim those parts of our reality by...
Well, Freud claimed that religion and anything irrational was just a stage that people passed through,
right,
or societies would pass through.
Right.
And that...
on their way to...
Yeah, to...
absolute rational.
Spock-like rationality.
Yeah.
And I have to disagree.
Ditto.
We need something. We need the irrational.
Yeah.
We are not beings of perfect reason.
No. And I think that this comes around to why that there is such a kind of deep need, want, kind of right now for some sort of transformative experience within a lot of people. And I think that's part of the reason why people, you know, end up with addiction issues and various things like that is, you know, in seeking change, they get stuck in the same. And I mean, addictions go right across the board for me. I'm not just talking about, you know, various substances, but, you know, television, consumerism, you know, we are an addictive society on just every level fathomable. And I think part of that addiction is this desperate quest for transformation. Because we are in constant change without an actual transformation. So we're going through all the changes without the actual satisfaction of a transformation. Give us transformation, goddammit.
Right, without a decisive event.
That's right, that's right. And this actually
makes everything new again.
That's right. And that was, you know, part of the men's movement back in the early 90s was talking about how most men have never had an initiatory experience marking their transition into manhood. And that it's the underlying kind of anxiety that most men in Western culture feel. They never really